This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Mira Sivasothi. In our Health and Living segment today, we're going to be discussing World Digestive Health Day. It was the 29th of May, which was yesterday, and this year the global campaign focuses on inflammatory bowel disease. But how many of us know about this organ and organs that are involved in the digestive system? So we're going to go through the 101 on your bowel, and we'll also touch on inflammatory bowel disease. In the studio with me, Dr. Mahendra Raj, a consultant gastroenterologist. So welcome to the show, Doctor. How are you today?
I'm fine, Mira. Thank you very much for having me on your show again.
You are most welcome. You know, when you talk about the bowel, Doctor, we always think about, we'll use these terms, intestines, bowel, and your gut. We use it interchangeably. Is there a difference between all three?
Well, yes. The gut basically refers to the entire gastrointestinal tract, predominantly the small intestine and the large intestine. So the gut is a general term which covers both the small intestine and the large intestine. The other word for the large intestine is the colon.
Okay. Yeah. And what about the rectum and the anus? Is that part of it as well?
The rectum is the bottom end, the bottom 15 to 20 centimeters of the colon. The anus is really the very bottom couple of centimeters between the inner world of the colon and the external environment.
Okay. So when you say gut is the small and the large intestine, then when we use the word intestine and bowel, is that the same thing?
I think bowel, intestine and gut are interchangeable terms. Mm-hmm. But when we want to subdivide it, it's really the small intestine and the large intestine.
Okay. You just want to go through what happens from the time we put food in our mouth all the way to when it actually comes out. What happens?
Any of you who have done science in primary and secondary schools, so when we put food in the stomach, the first thing that happens is that we chew the food. It mixes with the saliva, which has enzymes. And then when it's soft enough to swallow, it's swallowed through down the esophagus, which connects the mouth to the stomach, and that the esophagus is a muscular tube which propels the food down into the stomach. And when it's in the stomach churns around and mixes the food with the digestive juices in the stomach, which consists of acid and enzymes and a little bit of bile. And this process helps in breaking up the food into simpler molecules, and then when it's churned and made softer into a kind of a semi-liquid form, it's then pushed into the upper part of the small intestine, which is the duodenum, and then the food makes its way right down this long tube called the small intestine, which is about, anything between 3 and 10 meters long. And in the small intestine, further digestion occurs, and eventually most of the nutrients which can be absorbed are absorbed in the small intestine. But there are some components of food which are not absorbed. For example, vegetable fibers cannot be absorbed. So the undigested part or the part of the food which is not absorbed finds its way into the large intestine. And in the large intestine, what's left behind from the work of the small intestine is subjected to movements. And the water content of what's left behind is reabsorbed in the colon. And so that liquid residue becomes more solid, and then that solid is eventually evacuated in the toilet.
Okay. All right. Very interesting. While you're at it, and I'm probably going to digress a little, as you are explaining this process, you know how you have products nowadays of people coming and telling me that if you take this, it will block the fat. If you take this, it will block the sugar absorption. Now, I've always wondered whether or not when it moves from the stomach to the duodenum and the intestine, what's telling those organs to not accept sugar or to not accept fat? Is that even possible?
Well, by and large, most of the carbohydrate and most of the fat is actually absorbed, except for the undigestible carbohydrates, all right? So the undigestible carbohydrates are usually from plant matter, and they are not absorbed. There are certain medication which can actually block the absorption, especially of fats, and they are used sometimes in weight loss regimes. They are not a sustained answer to weight loss, but these drugs do exist.
Where is this blocking happening?
It's happening along the small intestine.
Okay.
It's along the small intestine. But we now know, actually, I mean, I'm digressing. We now know that within the small intestine, the large intestine, are trillions and trillions of species of bacteria, millions of species. And we're now beginning to uncover some facts about these bacteria. They are not just passive inhabitants of the small intestine, large intestine. They actually have an important symbiotic function with the host. And some of these bacteria may, to some extent, influence the differential absorption of nutrients. And they may actually have a role to play even in the pathogenesis of obesity or being fat.
Wow.
Yeah.
Going forward, you need to look at these bacteria more closely for sure.
I think one of the major areas of research in the bowel now is to understand this so-called microbiome. In fact, it's so important that people are now beginning to realize that it may be an organ of its own, in its own right, mm-hmm. performing a very important function in the human body.
Okay.
And you know, if it is true that the bacteria can influence variable absorptions of nutrients, then they are potential targets for developing drugs which might actually help combat obesity.
Do you think there's still a long way to
understand?
It's
a very, very long way. I think it's very promising. The mysteries are only just beginning to be unraveled. But I think in the future, they hold the key to a lot of problems relating to obesity.
Okay, but then again, do you think we are taking advantage of this very little information and commercialising it?
No, because I don't think we're ready yet to commercialise this particular information as regards the bacteria. I think we're a long, long way from that.
Well, what about fecal transplantation? That probably, you know, stems from this understanding, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, look, we understand that the gut microbiome or bacteria play a role not only in things like obesity and diabetes and things, but they may also have a role to play in certain conditions such as inflammatory bowel disease, mm-hmm. you know, which you alluded to just a little bit earlier in the program. Inflammatory bowel disease is a condition where there is unexplained inflammation of the gut. And it's a chronic disorder. Anyone can get an acute, short-lived inflammation. When we get food poisoning, that's what happens. But in inflammatory bowel disease, it's a chronic, long-standing problem. And it's been shown that there may be some role for so-called fecal transplantation in curing these diseases, or at least helping in recovery of these diseases. And what that involves basically is taking the feces of one human being with its own unique bacterial pattern and composition and putting it into the gut of another human
being.
Yes,
and we don't want to talk about how it's done because
we will spare the details on this show. The show might be banned after this.
But is that something that's proven, or do we know enough about fecal transplantation?
I think there's early evidence to suggest that fecal transplantation does have a role in the management of inflammatory bowel disease, but it's not a panacea. So it's not the be-all and end-all, but I think it has a promising role. And maybe in the course of time, that role actually will become progressively more important.
Okay, we'll come back to inflammatory bowel disease, which is, you know, part of this year's theme for World Digestive Day. But while we're on the topic of bacteria, what about probiotics?
Well, probiotics, as you know, are basically bacteria which are normally found in a healthy gut. And, you know, there's a big industry in probiotics. There's no question that probiotics has been shown unequivocally to be of use in certain conditions. For example, after an acute episode of food poisoning, acute gastroenteritis, which is basically due to not-so-nice bacteria, the probiotics do have some role in promoting recovery. In patients who develop diarrhea due to antibiotics, probiotics have been shown to be of value. And that's the reason for that is because when people take antibiotics, they kill off some of the good bacteria. Some nasty bacteria then flourish in the gut and cause an acute inflammation in the colon, they get diarrhea. So in that kind of condition, probiotics has been shown to be of value. Then there's this big illness called irritable bowel syndrome. It's not actually, it's a condition called irritable bowel syndrome. Mm-hmm. And there's some evidence that probiotics may help a subset of patients with irritable bowel syndrome. But in this condition, I think it's not, it's certainly not a panacea. It may benefit some people, but it's not, again, the be-all and end-all of the treatment of irritable bowel syndrome.
And to bear in mind that irritable bowel disease and irritable bowel syndrome are two completely different conditions. We'll come to that in just a short while. But how do we ensure then that our digestive system is conducive for good gut bacteria, you know, and we not to wait to have to take probiotics?
Look, probiotics have almost become like a normal health supplement, and a lot of people take probiotics. I think the evidence that taking probiotics continuously improves your health gut is a little bit equivocal, but it certainly does no harm. How do we ensure that we have a good gut health and good bacteria? Well, I guess, firstly, you have to have a balanced diet. Number two, excessive use and unnecessary use of antibiotics definitely alters the gut bacteria. So that's one thing where we can all play a role. I mean, there's a lot of pressure among doctors especially to prescribe antibiotics because patients often demand antibiotics. And there are many situations, common coughs and colds, where antibiotics are not necessary. So I think that's a big area where we can actually intervene to reduce, to improve the gut health, as it were.
Mm. And if you don't prescribe the antibiotics, then they just move on to the next doctor.
Absolutely right. That's what happens, yeah.
I had somebody who said to me, you know, yeah, the first doctor there wasn't able to cure my, you know, my cold. Yeah. So I went to the next one. And then finally, the last one, it worked.
Absolutely.
And I'm like, it probably became an infection then.
Either that, or if you wait long enough, most coughs and colds get better. So if you go, if you have to see a doctor, I think if the 10th doctor, your success rate becomes quite high.
Okay, because either you're on the mend or, you know, you needed that antibiotic.
Yes.
You know. Okay, so we are discussing World Digestive Health Day, and that was yesterday. In the studio with me, Dr. Mahendra Raj, a consultant gastroenterologist. We'll come back and find out more about irritable bowel disease and irritable bowel syndrome. Well, colorectal cancer, it's one of the leading cancers amongst men in Malaysia. It's number one, actually. So if you have a question for us, our phone lines are open. It's 03-77-109-000. You can tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 016-201-9000. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasuthi. It's our Health and Living segment, and in the studio with me, Dr. Mahendra Raj, consultant gastroenterologist. We are discussing your bowel. It's World Digestive Health Day. It was yesterday. Never too late, isn't it, to talk about it, and Dr. Mahendra
yes.
Raj. We have a question here from somebody. By the way, if you want to give us a call, the number is 03-77-109-000. You can tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 016-201-9000. I'm sure you have a lot of questions about your digestive tract. As Dr. Mahendra Raj explained, it starts right from the mouth all the way till it's excreted from the system. Question here, how bad is constipation?
How common a problem it is? I mean, constipation is a very common problem. Is it, if you're constipated, then the quality of life is definitely impaired, you know? I mean, the normal bowel habits of individuals vary quite widely. Some people are quite fine going to the toilet once every 2-3 days and doesn't bug them in any way. Some people go twice a day, and if they're happy with that situation, that's fine. But some people have very severe constipation. It goes several days without going to the bowel, and people like that often have severe pain. They're uncomfortable. They're bloated and distended. That's a severe end of the spectrum, and it can have a major impact on quality of life. Sometimes, though, we have to be careful, and that constipation may just be a symptom of a very serious underlying problem, such as colon cancer. While the majority of patients with constipation probably do not have something serious like colon cancer, it can be a symptom of something more serious underlying.
Okay. Before we go on to irritable bowel disease and syndrome.
Irritable bowel syndrome and inflammatory bowel disease.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah. I'm using the same words, just, you know, altering the last word. We spoke about the gut microbiome just now.
Yes.
Is there a link with the brain?
There is, you know. I mean, that's a fascinating link. I mean, we've all we've all been told since youth about, you know, how we get butterflies in our stomach when we're nervous. Well, there's now evidence linking the composition of the bacteria in the gut with conditions such as even depression and autism. And it's to do with the way the bacteria in the gut handle some of the nutrient constituents in the gut, which results in the production of various chemicals which are absorbed by the body into the bloodstream and then act as neurotransmitters or chemicals in the brain. So there's this link between the gut and the brain. Unquestionably, there's a link. The link hasn't been worked out with any great certainty, but there's very strong corroborative evidence that the gut does have a role to play in the genesis of mental diseases such as anxiety, depression, and perhaps even autism.
Wow. Yeah. Is there anything we can go out and do today to maintain?
I'd be a fraud if I said yes.
Healthy microbiome, because I don't want to think about what state it's in at the moment, given our lifestyle and our dietary habits.
You know, apart from not consuming unnecessary antibiotics, I don't think we can, from purely scientific way, I don't think we can be absolutely categorical about what's going to determine our gut flora, as it were. From a young age, I think it's important to have a healthy, well-balanced diet. Obviously, if you're going to have diets which are very high in refined foods, there's no question that it's going to affect your microbiome. So while we cannot be absolutely categorical, I think some of the old-fashioned common sense advice of having a well-balanced meal with fruits and vegetables is probably quite good. There's this whole, we talk about probiotics, but there are also these things called prebiotics, which are basically vegetable compounds, carbohydrates in vegetables, which seem to promote the growth of good bacteria in the gut. And obviously, if they come from plant matter, we have to make sure that we have adequate plant matter naturally in our diet.
Well, could you give me some examples?
Have a wide range of vegetables in your diet, whether it's leafy vegetables, carrots, spinach, whatever. You've got to have a wide range of vegetables which have a wide range of these substances which can promote microbiome. I don't think you can pick one or two vegetables and say, I'm just going to eat carrots or cabbage all my life. I think diversity is very important in your diet.
Okay. Everybody is juicing. Everybody is, you know, smoothing up their fruit and veg.
Sure.
What are your thoughts on that?
I think the smoothing and the juicing is a little bit of overkill. I think that you need vegetables in adequate quantities. I'm not sure that there's any strong evidence in the medical literature to say that juicing and smoothing all these vegetables and consuming in that way is superior to consuming adequate vegetables in the normal way, in a normal, well-balanced diet.
I think why we do it is because we are not consuming it in our normal diet.
Sure. So. I guess if you have no time to eat a proper diet, and that's the only way to get that quantum of vegetables into you by drinking, juicing, then I guess it's something that it's better than nothing.
I've always wondered about the fiber content. Forget about juicing because there's no fiber in there. But what about when you smoothie up some?
Well, I guess as long as you're not filtering and getting rid of the vegetables, then the fiber content is not going to be destroyed just by smoothing it.
Okay, and I'm sure you love this next question of mine about detox.
Oh, goodness. Read my mind.
I know.
You know, the detox. The answer for all our ills is to just go out and detox. Do whatever we like, and then there's something called detox, which just,
get rid of the toxins.
Get rid of the toxins.
And
mitigates everything we do.
Yeah.
There's no simple answer. I think detox is also another myth which has been propagated.
Really?
Yeah, I think so.
You think so?
Yes, I think so. Look, you know, people detox by what? Doing colon cleansing and all kinds of things.
You have fruit detox, you have colon cleansing, you have, you know, the Ayurveda way of detoxing.
Yeah, I won't comment too much about Ayurveda way of cleansing because, you know, Ayurveda is something which has been practiced over thousands of years. Unfortunately, it's not chronicled in the medical literature, so we can't make any objective judgment of that. But when it comes to colon cleansing, we know for a fact that that's a more recent tradition and that there's no scientific evidence in the medical literature to show that it has got any great benefits. In fact, Quite the converse, there have been reports in the medical literature of adverse effects from colon cleansing due to inadvertent colonic injury, sometimes even renal failure and heart failure in people who are predisposed to those diseases.
Yeah. Let's talk about fasting. It's a Ramadan month. The Muslims are all fasting. That's been told to be it's a good way of, you know, to rejuvenate gut health. Is that true? I mean, in all, you know, many religions advocate fasting as well.
Sure. Look, I mean, in general, many religions advocate fasting, and I'm sure when you fast, there's some kind of spiritual benefit to the body, and when there's a spiritual benefit to the body, I'm pretty sure there's a physical benefit to the body as well. How exactly physiologically it helps, I don't think has been worked out all that clearly. Certainly, during the fasting period, the overall food consumption would usually be lower. So your overall calorie consumption, your sugar consumption, fat consumption should be lower. So from that point of view, it has health benefits, particularly in people who are overweight. Many people are overweight, find that they lose weight during the fasting month. So maybe that's the way that it actually helps people. Whether or not it specifically detoxifies you is, I think, a little open to question.
Okay, all right then. We'll leave that for now. Let's move on to irritable...
Inflammatory bowel disease,
which is IBD. The global campaign this year, inflammatory bowel disease. You want to go through that with us? That's pretty much disorders that involve Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis.
Inflammatory bowel disease are a group of conditions, and you mentioned the two, ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, which result from chronic inflammation of the gut. All right, Crohn's disease actually can affect the entire gastrointestinal tract from the mouth to the rectum. Ulcerative colitis affects only the colon. The main feature of these two conditions is that the inflammation is chronic, which means it's long-standing. And often the conditions are said to remit and relapse, which means they flare up, cause a lot of problems, and sometimes can fade down even by themselves and then flare up and fade down. And so they're a chronic condition which people suffer from over many, many years.
Is it an autoimmune disease?
Well, in some sense it is, because in effect it is because the immune system of the body turns onto itself and attacks the tissues of the gastrointestinal tract. So from that point of view, it is an immune-related disease. It's a disease which has been common in the West for many, many, many years. And for many, many, many years, it was uncommon in the East, in Asia. Mm-hmm. But in recent years, there's no question that the incidence in Asia is rising. And even during my, 35-odd years in Malaysia as a gastroenterologist, there's been a very perceptible increase in the incidence of inflammatory bowel disease in Malaysia over the years.
Is there a reason for that?
Well, the speculated reason is that it has something to do with our lifestyle and environment, which means it could be the westernization of our lifestyle and dietary intake has a role to play. We don't know absolutely for sure, but that's probably the reason for it.
Okay. a lot of literature I was reading, Scotland seems to have a lot of digestive health problems in the bowel especially. Mm. Why Scotland?
Well, I don't know why Scotland, actually. I mean, look, like all diseases, they're multifactorial. There's a genetic predisposition and then there's the environmental predisposition. Mm-hmm. It could be that the genetics in the Scottish population are such, and in fact, the environment and socioeconomic factors are such that they predispose to certain conditions. For example, in Scotland for a long time, the bug Helicobacter pylori in the stomach and ulcer disease was very common. Coronary disease, heart disease, is quite common, and that's to do with lifestyle, diet, and I'm sure to a certain extent genetics.
Okay. Yeah. And there was a gene that's been identified, MDRI. Have you heard of that one?
Yeah.
Does that sort of apparently the function, it has some link to IBD?
There have been a number of genes which have been identified which are thought to predispose to inflammatory bowel disease. And, you know, nowadays the progress in genetics is so rapid that people have been very good at identifying genes. Again, none of these genes are an absolute in the sense that not everyone with this gene will develop inflammatory bowel disease. And there will be many patients with inflammatory bowel disease who don't have the gene. But If you have these genes, then the risk of developing inflammatory bowel disease is higher than if you don't have the gene.
Okay, and is it a condition which could possibly increase your risk for colorectal cancer?
Absolutely.
Inflammatory bowel disease. Absolutely.
As a general principle in medicine, any part of the body which is subject to long-standing chronic inflammation can predispose to cancer. So ulcerative colitis and Crohn's colitis, which causes long-standing inflammation in the colon, predisposes to colon cancer. And that risk becomes higher the longer you have the disease. So after about 10 or 15 years, there's a very substantial increase in the risk of colorectal cancer in these patients.
If you have a question, our phone lines are open. The number is 03-7710-9000. You can tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 016-201-9000. Colorectal cancer is one of the leading cancers amongst men in Malaysia. Why do you think that's the case?
Why? Yeah, I mean, I know, Mira, I don't think I can honestly answer that question. Apart from that, to say, like many diseases which were common in the West years ago and now are becoming increasingly common in the East, we can only speculate that lifestyle, diet, environment has a major role to play. And again, it could well be westernization of our diet.
Why the men?
Because women have breasts. And so the commonest cause of cancer in women is breasts. Whereas in men, the commonest cause is colon cancer. The second commonest cause of cancer in women is colon cancer.
Yep.
So it's a little less common among men than women, but it's by no means uncommon in women. You know, it's just that breast cancer is far more common. And so that it's not necessarily that there's a very wide gender gap in the incidence of colorectal cancer between men and women.
Okay. Obesity, and I'm going to say this for the millionth time.
Yes.
We are the fattest nation in Southeast Asia. Mm. We lead
with
in terms
best food.
Of diabetes.
Yep.
It's so unfair, isn't it? I mean,
yeah,
we have the best food and,
yeah,
you know, it's not doing us any good. Bowel cancer caused by obesity. Is that a very strong statement
There's a strong association between obesity and colon cancer. It's not the only factor, all right? There are genetic factors and the environment factors. Whether or not being fat per se causes colon cancer, or whether or not the same people who are fat and eat all the unhealthy food also eat food which predisposes to colon cancer is open to speculation. And then there's also this link again with microbiomes. We know that gut bacteria influence obesity. To some extent, they may play a role in obesity. And gut bacteria may also, by a mechanism directly or indirectly, cause colorectal cancer. So there are a lot of speculative mechanisms, but there's certainly an association. Association means, by and large, colorectal cancer is more common in fat people than thinner people. It's not absolute. But what the link is between the two is a little bit more difficult to dissect out.
But I suppose the underlying takeaway goes back to lifestyle, really.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no question. I mean, I think there's no plus side to being obese. Being obese increases the risk of a variety of conditions, and it's important to control your weight. No question about it.
We have a question from Mr. Fu SH. He says, my son has been diagnosed to have a leaky gut problem. He's allergic to dairy products and eggs. These problems have caused him to have itchy and dry skin. What's your advice?
Yeah. This leaky gut, he probably has an allergy to some of the proteins in these products. And because he's allergic to these things, the immune system reacts with these proteins and causes damage to the gut. And when it causes damage to the gut, it can cause even bowel symptoms such as diarrhea and pain and whatnot. His condition would fall in the remit of two subspecialties, perhaps the gastroenterologist and an allergist. And now there's an emerging subspecialty of people who specialize in allergies and allergic disorders, and he should see one of these people. It could be that the simple answer is just to do a panel of tests on what he may be allergic to and then go down the common sense path of just avoiding these foods which contain these substances. There are also a whole host of drugs which can sometimes dampen down the allergic reaction to these things.
We will come back and find out more about inflammatory bowel syndrome.
Disease.
Yes, look at me. My goodness. What will I do without you, Dr. Mahendra? Okay, so we're discussing World Health Digestive Day. We're talking all about your bowel and your digestive system. You have a question for Dr. Mahendra Raj, give us a call. The number is 0377 109 000. You can tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 0162019 000. We'll be back right after this market update on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Mira Sivasodhi. In our Health and Living segment today, I have Dr. Mahendra Raj, a gastroenterologist. We're discussing your bowel or your whole digestive system because it was World Digestive Health Day yesterday. If you have a question, once again, give us a call 0377 109 000, tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 0162019 000. We have a question here, Dr. Mahendra Raj. If I only have bowel movements every 2 to 3 days once, will I be at a higher risk in terms of getting colon cancer?
I don't think you can say that you are at a higher risk of developing colon cancer just because you're opening your bowels once every 2 or 3 days. If that's your pattern over a long period of time, you're comfortable with it, you don't have any symptoms, I don't think you are at particularly higher risk of colon cancer than someone who opens the bowels every day.
Okay, next question. Why do I always have so much gas in my stomach that causes me to burp more than normal?
Yeah, the ubiquitous gas. You know, we Malaysians have an obsession with gas and angin and everything. And it's a word which is used to describe a multitude of symptoms. You know, angin. Angin is actually an interpretation. If by what you mean gas, you mean you seem to belch or burp excessively, then it could be that you have this condition called gastroesophageal reflux disease, which means the gastric juices from the stomach have a greater propensity to reflux or regurgitate back up into the esophagus. And that's one of the causes of belching. Another common cause of belching is this condition called aerophagy. People who tend to be a bit nervous, or people who sometimes eat too quickly, sometimes swallow a little bit more air than normal. And that can sometimes predispose us to belching. And then, of course, some people belch because they have a discomfort in the chest. And unfortunately, that discomfort in the chest can be due to so many things. It can be due to gastroesophageal reflux. Equally, it can even be due to heart disease. So you'd be surprised the number of people who sometimes have heart symptoms and chest pain. And because they have the symptom, they attribute it to trapped air in the chest. They try and belch it out, so it could just be a symptom of heart disease. So one of the commonest causes, though, of excessive belching is gastroesophageal reflux disease.
Okay, but with the heart problem, it will sort of only present when you are having problems with the heart, or is it a long-term thing?
When you're having problems, if you have a heart problem, it can present in many ways. Sometimes it's chest discomfort, sometimes it's lower chest and upper abdominal discomfort. And sometimes the symptoms of heart problems and gastroesophageal reflux are indistinguishable. And so, yes, you have these symptoms when you have a heart problem.
Okay. Yeah. Next question, can you damage the inner lining of your intestine? And how serious is that?
Yes, you can damage the inner lining of the intestine. Depends on how severe the damage is and what you take. For example, if you swallow severe corrosive liquids, then you can cause very serious damage to the esophagus, stomach. And in Malaysia, in certain segments of society, people commit suicide by swallowing very corrosive liquids and have suffer. The other very common thing which can damage the inner lining of the gut is actually painkillers. Certain painkillers, which we call non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, which many of us use for rheumatic pains and muscle pain, joint pains, can potentially damage the inner lining of the gut, especially the stomach and even the intestine. And while most people who take these drugs won't have any serious damage, a few people, a small proportion of people, may develop serious damage, and which may result in bleeding or even perforation in the gut.
But that's rare, would you say?
You know, because pain...
Because the reason I ask you is because many of us are on it.
It's not rare. It's like this. Because these drugs are prescribed and used so widely, even a small proportion of a large number is quite a large number. So it's by no means rare to see patients coming in with ulcer bleeding and damage due to the consumption of these drugs.
Consumption in a long term or just a short term?
Well, obviously, the longer you consume it, the higher the risk. But the risk is not zero, even if you take it in the short term.
Okay, all right. Thanks for that. Is there any way of knowing that this is happening?
Well, of course, if you start getting pain or you see your stool turn black or you vomit blood, you know that it's happening. But if you have no symptoms at all, then, you know, you're probably fine.
Fine, okay. Next question. My niece is 20 years of age, has bowel problems for years now. She just does not move bowels for more than a week, and this is a regular problem. Will her chances of colorectal cancer, is it high or not? It's pretty much the same as the other one, actually.
I think, you know, having only being able to open your bowels once a week must be quite distressing for her, because just from the point of view of quality of life, and she should see someone about how she can best manage it, you know. And there are ways of trying to manage this, sometimes with the aid of medications. But it's not particularly a very high risk factor for colorectal cancer. I mean, things like family history of colorectal cancer, even obesity, may actually be higher risk factors.
Okay, so look out for family histories. So always blame the family when you don't know anything about causes.
Yes. Blame the family.
Irritable bowel syndrome. Thank you. And that's a common disorder. I mean, you see that
very
all the
common
time
disorder
with
many
people. You want to tell us a little bit more about that?
Irritable bowel syndrome is a condition. Very common, may affect even in some societies, even up to 15 to 20% of the population. And the characteristics of this, of the illness, is symptoms of abdominal pain, discomfort, bloating, associated with alteration in the bowel pattern. Some people are constipated, some people have a bit of diarrhea. And it's something which is a long-standing problem. You'll find people with IBS saying, oh, I always have a sensitive tummy. I've always had a sensitive tummy since I was young. So it's a very common condition. And to understand it, we have to understand that the gut is basically a long muscular tube with a very complex network of nerves and nerve cells, almost like a very complex internet network. And in patients with irritable bowel syndrome, the nerve cells are a bit too sensitive and result in alterations in the propulsive muscular movements of the gut. And so they have these symptoms. The good thing about this group of conditions is that they don't carry serious complications. They don't result in death. They don't predispose to cancer. They will almost never result in an operation, but they sure as hell impact on quality of life.
I can imagine. I mean, it's called the cramping, abdominal pain, bloating, diarrhea.
Yeah.
The works, really. Do we know what causes it?
Again, a lot of speculation. And it's often called a biopsychosocial disorder, which means that we know very little about it.
That goes back to the brain.
I'm being a little bit facetious,
You're now you're talking like a psychiatrist.
You know, clearly there's a biological basis for this, and it's to do with the sensitivity of the nerves and altered function of the muscle. There's also a psychological factor, because we know that if you have IBS, then during periods of emotional stress or distress, then the symptoms are often accentuated. So there is the cerebral input which actually influences the severity of the symptoms. And there's a social kind of component to it as well. And again, now we're beginning to uncover the fact that the good old-fashioned gut microbiome may also have a role to play. How it plays a role, nobody knows for sure, but it may influence the nerve function in the gut and also influence the chemicals which influence brain function.
And does food play a big role in managing irritable bowel syndrome?
Yeah. You know, traditionally, the link between food and irritable bowel syndrome was a minefield of confusion because everyone's an individual. Some people say, I mean, I can't eat this and I can't eat that. And, you know, if they have the personal experience with them, then they should do that. But more recently, there's been quite good science about a group of foods which we call FODMAPs. The acronym is F-O-D-M-A-P-S, which stands for, this is a long thing, fermentable oligodimonosaccharides and polyols. But basically what it is, it's a group of carbohydrates which are found in various foods. And there's some evidence that foods which have a high FODMAPs content tend to aggravate irritable bowel syndrome symptoms, at least in a group, in a proportion of these patients, whereas foods with a low FODMAPs tend not to. So they now have websites on these FODMAPs, and people sometimes find that if they look at the whole list of these foods with high FODMAPs and low FODMAPs contents and adjust the food accordingly, they may get some symptom relief. So this is one of the things which has emerged recently as potentially being helpful in patients with IBS.
Some common examples of foods with high FODMAPs?
You know, there's you know, certain things. Cabbage, for example, may have high FODMAPs. There's certain types of vegetables which may have high FODMAPs. Things like leafy vegetables tend to have lower FODMAPs. So leafy vegetables tend to be a little bit better in patients with irritable bowel syndrome. But, you know, these things, the list of these things are quite exhaustive, and they can be easily seen on very reputable websites on the net now.
Okay, so FODMAPs, you want to go and have a look at that. Meanwhile, there's so much about being gluten intolerant.
Yes,
oh, my goodness me.
Yes,
everybody.
It's almost fashionable to be gluten intolerant.
It is. And what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, we've got to be clear about a few things. There's the condition called celiac disease, all right, where there is true gluten hypersensitivity, which means if you take gluten, and gluten basically is a component of various grains, including wheat. And in true celiac disease, if you take gluten, it causes structural damage to the lining of the small intestine, which results in very real symptoms such as diarrhea, weight loss, and actually can be a very serious condition. That particular condition, celiac disease, tends to be far commoner in Caucasian populations than in Asian populations. Now, gluten intolerance is something else. Gluten intolerance is when taking gluten causes symptoms but doesn't actually structurally damage the intestine that much. So it's not celiac disease. So gluten intolerance might be something which causes symptoms very akin to irritable bowel syndrome. And it could just be, it has been suggested that it may not be the gluten, it just could be that many foods which contain gluten also contain higher proportions of these foods with high FODMAP contents. Okay. So it's something which people notice on their own. It's not easy to test for. It's very easy to test for celiac disease. There are very specific tests for that. For gluten intolerance, it's a bit more difficult to test for that. And I think sometimes gluten is given bad press. I think
far too much bad press,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah.
Your screening, yeah. How important is that?
Well, I think screening is important. Screening, certainly for colon cancer, is a very important thing because there's now ample evidence that screening for colorectal cancer saves lives. And there are many countries with well-established programs, and it has made a major impact on the incidence of colon cancer screening. And a number of ways of screening for colon cancer. In Malaysia, there are efforts afoot to try and encourage screening, to try and implement screening programs. And the number of ways of screening. I mean, there are simple tests such as stool tests, looking for what we call occult blood, which means hidden blood, invisible blood in the stool. And then there's kind of more invasive tests such as colonoscopies, mm-hmm. which mean putting a scope into the colon to directly examine the colon for evidence of colon cancer and for evidence of what we call polyps in the colon. Polyps are small growths in the colon which are not malignant yet, but have the potential to turn to cancer. And one of the main reasons for screening is to look for these polyps in the colon and take them out so that they don't have a chance to turn into colon cancer.
So what should we do now? If I want to start screening,
yep.
Should I just go out and get a stool test done?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, if you're 50 years old and you don't have a particularly strong family history of colorectal cancer, then a reasonable place to start would be to go to your doctor and ask for an occult blood test, stool occult blood test. And that would involve giving a tiny sample of stool, which would be analyzed. And if it's positive for occult blood, then you'd be referred for a colonoscopy to look for polyps and early cancer. The thing about the occult blood is that it's not a 100% test. So there'll be some patients or some people, not patients yet, some people with polyps who may have a negative occult blood. So there's a slight limitation. The other option, of course, is the slightly more expensive and invasive option, and that is to do a colonoscopy. There are many people in many countries who at the age of 50 undergo a once-in-a-lifetime colonoscopy, where they see a gastroenterologist and they have their entire colon directly examined by colonoscopy. The positive side of a colonoscopy, of course, is that in terms of accuracy of detecting polyps and colon cancer, it's very good. And if there is a polyp, then it can be taken out immediately. So these are the options which are available generally in Malaysia.
As you mentioned earlier, you've been in this field of gastroenterology almost, 35 years now?
30 years.
What's keeping you excited about, you know, going forward?
Well, I think gastroenterology has evolved so much even since the time when I started training. And the whole thing about endoscopy is when I first started training, or when I was a medical student, my teachers who were gastroenterologists would talk a lot about gastroenterology, but none of them actually had ever looked into the inside of a stomach or a colon. Now we can look inside the colon and the stomach. There are many things which are interventional that we can do. And I think the understanding of the gut microbiome and how it influences not just gastrointestinal diseases, but maybe even mental diseases, obesity, diabetes is fascinating, and I think that's where the action is and that's where the excitement lies.
That's fantastic. Would you have a message for us this World Digestive Health Day, which was yesterday?
I think on a pragmatic level, colon cancer screening, I think, is an important thing to do for people after the age of 50. And I would say to you, go and see your doctor and see what can be done, because it's a preventable cancer.
Thank you very much for joining us today. That was Dr. Mahendra Raj, consultant gastroenterologist, talking to us about your digestive system on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.